tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
You want to know so that you can tip your server the right amount. And maybe that amount is zero. Good Friday to you. I'm Bill Radke, debating this week's news with Seattle City Council member from the Socialist Alternative Party, Kshama Sawant. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First time on this show. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
The host of Public Radio's Live Wire, Luke Burbank. Hey, Luke.
Hey, now.
Thanks for coming in. And the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Hi, Joni Balter.
Good morning, Bill Radke.
So, thank you. So, this week, Seattle's minimum wage began to rise toward an eventual $15 an hour. Ivor's Restaurant says in its Lake Union store, its full-service store, not the little, walk-up fast food place on the waterfront, Ivor's is doing away with tipping. Starting now, menu prices are up 21%. Your server will make $15 an hour. A manager, when you come in, will explain the new no-tipping policy. The menu will say, no tipping, please. And there'll be no line on your credit card slip where you write in the tip amount. Kshama Sawant, you are the most famous champion of the 15 Now movement. Do you think the idea of no more tipping is good news or bad news?
Well, first of all, I hope everybody's taking in the big picture, which is that this was a historic victory for workers, which was won by a mass movement of workers and the labor movement and social justice organizations. And as far as the tipping policy of Ivor's goes, I think, you should go to the workers to understand whether this is going to be good or bad for them. And I'm not sure the verdict is in yet. First of all, I would say, approach it with a degree of skepticism. This is a restaurant owned by somebody who was very, very vocal in the anti-15 brigade, both in SeaTac and Seattle. So I'm not about to say that, oh, this is fantastic. But what actually happens depends on the numbers. How do workers fare at the end depends on what paycheck they actually get. So you have to think about the complications there. One is the number of hours the servers work matters. I mean, some of the servers I talked to, not at Ivor's, but I talked to some of the Space Needle restaurant workers, and I was also listening to a TV show yesterday or the day before, which was talking about how some of the wait staff there at Ivor's have made $18 in tips plus the $9.47 in minimum wage, and they're extremely concerned. So I would say bottom line is we should see how this works out for workers. Go to the workers to get the data, don't go to the owners. And ultimately, workers should be able to make these choices. And if workers are satisfied with what this happens, what this comes up with, that's great. But if they want to organize to reinstitute tipping, or if they want to organize for their further rights, then I think we need to support them.
And my understanding is that it's probably going to depend on who you are, whether you're going to be better or worse off in the no tipping regime. I mean, it gets into that they're going to give an 8% commission on sales to the wait staff, the back of house staffers, the cooks, et cetera. They get something different. So it gets very complicated as to who's happy and who's not. I'm curious about how we feel about the whole idea of just you pay what you pay and tipping doesn't exist anymore, Joni.
Well, think about Europe and many places that people travel to. It's a little hard to get used to when, I just came back from Florence myself. And I mean, you have these wonderful, highly paid, happy, they treat you well waiters, and then you're not supposed to tip them. But that's their cultures.
How highly paid are they? How do you know what the waiters
are? Well, I know they're
make?
Well paid. I know that they're well paid. I actually don't know the amount, but I know that they're well paid and that these are considered proud, good jobs. And so, but it's awkward. It feels funny to get up and say, oh, I'm not supposed to tip, or I'm supposed to tip only like really small percent. So it seems to work there. We would have a culture change here. I think one of the great things about the way this law was passed and will be enacted is that, remember, what they produced last year when this happened was a chart, not like a simple sentence about how this works. This is a chart. You have to follow it. And agreeing here with the councilwoman, it's going to take time to work it out. And that's what the time schedule embedded into that chart gives us.
Interesting. You said it feels weird and maybe impersonal to not give a tip. People feel so differently about this. At our Facebook page, Anton says, I tip because I am a server and I know the human connection tipping brings to a server-customer dynamic and the pride and the feeling that I have earned my money. It is something distinctly unique to American restaurant culture. I love my job and I love earning tips. And then we get a note from Taj who says, I hate tipping. I'd rather it just factored into the price. Plus, being nice for tips seems a bit like begging to me. And then he writes, did I just go too far there?
My wife and I were at a restaurant. We live in Port Townsend. We were at a restaurant a couple months ago. Very nice server. And she's helping this couple. And the guy has a really ridiculous complaint about his dish, which is that it didn't have as many prawns on it as his wife's dish. Like, she had like 9 prawns and he had 8.
Mm-hmm. Take the fork
so
out.
What would King Solomon do here?
The server, in a Solomonic move, she says, oh, I'm so sorry. I'll charge you for the small. So she takes like $4 off of his bill.
Wow.
And I hear the wife say to the husband, you tipped on the amount with the deduction, right? And he said, yeah. So in other words, they didn't want to accidentally tip on this imaginary $4 that they were discounted. And my point being, that server was not well served by the fact that this was a tip economy. She would have been better off just money because these guys were not going to tip her properly anyway.
That's absolutely correct. And that is why, you know, we've been fighting for a higher minimum wage. And indeed, we should be fighting for far more to have a much more encompassing action on workers' rights. It's not just about $15 an hour. We want that, and that's fantastic, but we need to keep going forward. And the tipping question.
Aren't you going to take one day to revel in this, Councilwoman?
I
feel like you're
always working.
You're on to the next project. Kick back for like an hour.
Well, you know, yesterday, actually, that's a good point. I agree. We should kick back, and I should also kick back. But yesterday, I was visiting Space Needle restaurant workers and elevator operators and all the workers, members of Unite Here, Local 8, who are struggling to get a good contract. And they are employees of the Howard Wright Corporation, which has denied them a pay raise for over 3 years, you know, over 1,000 days. So that's one of the reasons I can't rest, because I feel like that's my duty. But, you know, talking about tipping for a second, it is a complex issue. And the person on Facebook who said, you know, it sounds like begging, you have to be nice. Actually, that's a benign way of putting it. The reality is far more serious.
You almost have to flirt and bat your eyes.
It's not almost. It's real.
Yeah.
And if you look at Rock United Restaurant Opportunities organization nationwide, you know, they'll show you just mountains of research that reveals that, especially for women, it's a demeaning profession, in the sense that they have to engage in certain behaviors and also accept sexual harassment of the kind that they wouldn't accept it otherwise if their wages, first of all, their wages were a living wage. And that is why, you know, I think we have to hold government and the politicians accountable to make sure that workers get a living wage and nobody depends on tips. And then we can have a separate discussion on the culture and so on.
Well, most people actually tip nicely around here. We can only sort of use the example that's in front of us. But what Luke was talking about really does kind of set your teeth ajar a little bit when you think about that somebody's sitting there carefully calculating how to kind of get out of the tip that's clearly in front of them. She didn't have to give the 4 extra shrimp. That husband just get the fork out.
Isn't it weird we're talking about this person being a cheapskate about a gratuity that they don't even have to give at all? It's a very strange dynamic about,
right,
was the service fantastic? Am I doing a favor?
By the way,
am I equalizing the conditions of the worker?
And
what
ultimately,
am I doing?
And ultimately, I think the only conclusion you can draw is not to have a system which depends on the good behavior of every single customer. Instead, free the workers to have government-protected rights so that they don't depend on the vagaries of customer moods, whether they were happy with the number of prawns they got and so on, so that their lives are not dependent on that, you know?
I bet you those people are listening to this right now in Port Townsend and mortified, and as well they should be, in my opinion.
There you go.
I also think tipping is, for me anyway, it's about my own insecurity.
Yeah.
Like, it's about the tipper as much as the tip-e. Because, like, I tip a lot because I would be so embarrassed if the server looked at the tip and thought, boy, that guy's a real cheapskate. Other people are not as much inside their own heads as I am, and they probably feel comfortable tipping 15% or 10% if the service isn't great. So I would like to get rid of tips because I feel like I'm always over tipping, and there are some people that aren't tipping, and I feel like I'm propping them up. I'd rather we just even it out so we all just pay what the food should cost, the servers get the money that they deserve, and we get rid of this weird kind of awkwardness.
Well, I think then we have to really have a movement for a living wage, because ultimately I think the workers have to be involved in this process.
And how did I know that's what you were going to say?
And I also think that point aside, that you have to consider that the restaurants really are trying to make this work. You take somebody like Tom Douglas, and he's had his moments, and he's sputtered, and he's admitted that. He's been trying, you know, long before the law came into effect, to try to raise wages. He miscalculated there at the beginning, if everybody remembers that story, where he raised his sous chefs and then the dishwashers, some folks from the back of the house, up. But that miscalculation actually cost him more than he expected. More recently, he tried to put a 2% surcharge on, and then he called it back. People are trying to make this work. That's my point. And it has to be everybody, not just the workers. It has to be the restaurant.
Because I do think it's worth mentioning that a lot of restaurants do go out of business. There are some people who are making fabulous amounts of money owning restaurants, and a lot of people who are just breaking even or not making money. I mean, it's an expensive enterprise. And I do think there are some industries where if the owners plead poverty, it's hard to take them seriously. I don't think restaurants are actually in that grouping, in my mind. I mean, it's very tough for them, a lot of them, to actually pay the bills every month. So an adjustment in the amount of money that their workers are getting paid. I do think a guy like Dave Meinert, who runs the Five Point and basically everything on Capitol Hill at this point, right. You know, say what you want about Dave Meinert, but I don't think that he doesn't have his workers' best interest in mind. I know the guy, and that is my personal opinion. But he also points out some of the real challenges of something like this $15 an hour.
You know what? I'm going to pause you, not stop you, pause you, because we're going to bring up Dave Meinert and some of the fighting that it took to get to the happy week that's making Shama Sawant modestly smile right now on my right. We're going to talk about this a little bit more. So there's more to come on that. On the subject of tipping, it sounds like Luke thinks it's fine, do away with it. Joni finds it impersonal not to tip. And Shama Sawant did not surprise Luke when she says, that's not really the issue. We want to talk about what your next project is.
I love that.
City Council member Shama Sawant from the Socialist Alternative Party. Luke Burbank, Joni Balter, Bill Radke back in a moment with more Week in Review. We're full of vim and vinegar and lime juice this morning. And prawns on KOW's Week in Review with Luke Burbank and Joni Balter and Shama Sawant debating, discussing the week's news. Did Seattle and Washington State help change a law in Indiana? Last week, Indiana passed its Religious Freedom Restoration Act, letting businesses withhold services to people if it's for a religious reason. A lot of people saw this as a way to discriminate against gays and lesbians. Seattle's mayor signed an executive order banning official city travel to Indiana. Washington's governor issued a travel ban to Indiana for members of his administration. This week, Indiana made some changes to its law. First of all, City Council member Shama Sawant, is Seattle traveling to Indiana again? Do you know?
I think we should remember that the people in Indiana who support gay rights are on the same page as the people in Seattle who support gay rights. And I think that the executive order that the mayor took, I think that has a really important symbolic significance, in the sense that a political or moral condemnation of such a disgraceful position that has been taken by the government of Indiana does have an impact, because it empowers activists on the ground to take it from there. I mean, it's sort of in the realm of the resolution that was passed by the City Council this past Monday against the TPP and the fast track. You know, the Seattle Times mocked us by saying that, well, what does that mean anyway? The Seattle City does not have a legal jurisdiction on this.
This is a Pacific trade agreement.
Yes, and it's like, it's what the nation called NAFTA on steroids, meaning the impact, the detrimental impacts on farmers and the labor movement and the environment is going to be worse than you had in NAFTA. And so the question is, what impact does it have? It has a sort of an empowering and confidence-raising impact on activists in all other cities that are going to fight against it. So I think it has the same importance here, and I'm glad that this step was taken. And we also have to remember, in Indiana, other dark things are happening There is a criminalization of pregnancy that's happening. And the feticide laws have been applied to this woman, Purvi Patel, of Indian origin, who's been sentenced to 2 decades in prison because of this whole issue of what happened with her fetus. And I think that the fundamental point I would want to state here, both in gay rights and the question of women's rights and reproductive rights, is this. The right wing of the United States, is really pushing back on all the rights that were fought for and trying to take us back into the dark ages, not because they think that it's going to succeed or they think that American people are going to lie down and take it, but because it pushes the debate farther into the right rather than into the realms of what we really need to do, which is fight even more for justice. And really the question is, where's the Democratic Party on this? We need to build independent movements.
I want to ask about something that you said, talking with City Council Member Shama Sawant. You mentioned the symbolic significance of a stand that of the kind that Seattle took on this Indiana religious freedom issue. Let me ask all of you, my panel, about something of symbolic significance. What if Seattle's mayor, openly gay mayor, what if he held a news conference and declared anti-gay florists a protected minority? He said, if you want to boycott same-sex weddings in Seattle, Washington, you are so irrelevant and powerless that you are affecting no one. So we're going to legalize your discrimination. Good luck staying in business.
This is what I don't understand. Who is in the Venn diagram overlap of loves floral arrangements,
right,
not down with all this gay stuff?
Who's that?
Who is that florist?
Right.
Do they exist? Are they mythical?
More so in Indiana than Seattle, which is why I'm wondering, like, would you sign on to that, Shama Sawant?
I don't know if I can. I mean,
a symbolically significant declaration of who is the minority in this town and who isn't.
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask this, because although I'm laughing at the jokes that are being made, I probably cannot think of that in that way, because in the question of minorities is serious enough that I would only think of it in terms of people whose rights are really being marginalized. And I don't know if I would think of people who have bigotry against the gay community as a minority that needs to be protected. No, I think they need to be educated.
Well, I want to go back to the actions against the state of Indiana. Those were strong political stands by the mayor, the governor, the council, the whole business here. But you have to realize that business also took many, many businesses said, you know, and by the way, who was talking about Indiana like 2 weeks ago? They were not like
NCAA basketball fans.
Yeah, perhaps.
And by the way, these were businesses like Angie's List and like Salesforce. These are not like Whole Foods and like Do-Gooder.
Right.
It wasn't Patagonia. I mean, these were like pretty
Walmart
down the middle companies that were like, we're not going to play that.
And so I think that the impact was cumulative. It was the fact that it was a tidal wave of folks, a chorus, just absolutely yelling at Indiana for them to change. And as you know, one of the thoughts about even the change was that it didn't go far enough. But there was a chorus. There were people standing up. There were businesses standing up and saying, you know, this isn't okay anymore. We're not going to acknowledge this. We don't want to do business with it. Kill it.
I mean, I do think that if you want a pretty clear indicator of where the United States, the majority of the United States of America, is on the issues of gay acceptance and gay equality, I think we got a pretty clear indication last week, right? This was not even a debate where it was like, well, you know, they kind of have a point in Indiana. And there was, I mean, other than maybe Fox News or something, there was nobody standing up for this law. I mean,
Walmart wanted to change the law
in
Arkansas.
Like, this was a law that, like, Jan Brewer in Arizona was like, okay, guys, we can't sign this kind of law in Arizona.
Right.
So you know that it was sort of beyond the pale. And, I mean, as Shama was saying, I feel that this really highlights the when people mobilize in this country, the difference that they can really make. I mean, you do not want to tick off the business interests in the Hoosier state. I mean, that was probably the second that Mike Pence, the governor, signed that thing, his like bat phone on his desk just started lighting up with people from the Chamber of Commerce like, oh, hell no.
Right.
And that's why he had to backtrack. I don't think it was a social pressure. I think it was because business was really mad at him.
Okay, so nobody's signing on to Mayor Ed Murray's theoretical and non-existent symbolic declaration. But laws aside, does no part of you feel the least bit sorry for a Christian wedding photographer who legally must stand there and capture images of what she sees as the decline of morality and civilization. Even if you think, this is the laws we ought to have. She might be hateful, but you don't know that.
Public sphere, private sphere. That's really what you're talking about. Privately, your mythical florist can do whatever the heck they want. But once you're in business in the public sphere,
this is where the law.
This is where the laws apply, and you
agreed
have to follow them.
Not to mention that if you want to be...
Luke, you came from quite Christian stock.
I do. I hail from a very evangelical family. And these are other things that that same photographer could be worried about if they wanted to get serious about the Bible. Are the people getting married? Have they been coveting something?
Right.
Have they worshipped a false idol? Have they trimmed their beard? These are all things that are
Needs to look into their neighbor's jackass.
Right.
Because there's serious laws written about
These are rules that are in the Bible that can be found in the book of We Don't Talk About That Anymore.
Yes.
So if you, I understand why it happens, but somebody choosing this particular element of the Bible to find so reprehensible, if they're going to be consistent about it and they will not make a cake or bring flowers or take pictures of a wedding where either of the people have committed anything that in the Bible is considered off limits, then maybe I could get behind what they're doing. But they're choosing to focus on one thing and they're choosing to ignore other things.
When you find a consistent human, will you let me know?
Probably the closest. Seriously, Radke, you're probably the closest person to a consistent human I know.
One more question. City Council Member Shama Samwat, there are so many causes that you and the City Council could weigh in on. How do you choose which one to take an official stand on? And do you have private fights about that? Before it gets to a city council meeting, I just wonder, how do you decide what to take a stand
that's
on?
That's a very, very good question, actually. And that question applies not only to the public face of legislation, as you've applied the question to, but also what does one choose to fight for in terms of building a social sort of momentum around something, which is the only thing that really changes anything. And so if you talk about all of the things that we've focused on, or at least I've focused on in the year and 3 months that I've been on the City Council, $15 an hour, the fight against the Stepping Forward program of the Seattle Housing Authority, which had it gone through, would have increased for the rents of low-income families by 400%. If you look at all of these, there's a common sort of thread running through all of that, which is that in the system that we live in the economy that we live in, it's glaringly obvious in Seattle. It's an extremely wealthy city, and yet you see income and wealth inequality really rising and life becoming unlivable for a lot of people. What do you choose to fight on? You pick something that you know that a mass of people is willing to fight for. So you have to have a finger on the pulse of the consciousness of the city.
I was thinking about somebody else's city, Indiana, et cetera, circus animals, Indiana laws. How do you decide, this is worth the Seattle City Council's time and taxpayer?
As far as the Indiana question is concerned, this goes down to the very core of what Seattle and Washington State have led on, gay rights. This is important to take a stand on. But I really think that we also need to talk about the attack on reproductive rights in Indiana as well, and combine that and see that, again, these are not happening in an isolated fashion. The attack on gay rights, the attack on women's rights, they're part of this package of events that are happening where the right wing is trying to push the society even more to the right, and it creates this situation where we accept the lowest common denominator of what success is. We say, okay, if we defeat these really dastardly laws, then we've achieved success. We are not really moving society in the completely other direction that we need to.
Can I be difficult here for 1 minute and just sort of talk about the cumulative impact of the City Council taking these stands, these resolutions over the years? There is a downside to it. And the downside is, and I'm thinking Snake River Dams, that sure didn't make any friends. I'm thinking Trident Subs going back a ways. And I'm thinking the resolution that changed the name of manhole covers, remember this one, to maintenance covers, because man, woman, this goes back a little bit. But the gist
I wasn't aware of any of those.
That's what I'm getting at. So there is this cumulative impact, and it makes people think over time, all of them together, that you don't have enough to do.
I see your point, Joni, and I think that we need to have, we, meaning elected officials who are serving the public, need to have a serious approach on what issues we're going to take up, whether they are of tangible significance in terms of changing people's lives in Seattle, where we have a legal jurisdiction, or it's a question of symbolic significance. And I think another way to look at things that have symbolic significance is to say political leadership. You know, are you willing to step outside the realms of what's accepted in the status quo and show political leadership? And showing political leadership means having the courage to do something that is not that popular at this moment among the people in the elite, but is extremely popular among people on the ground. And one example I will give you is the letter I wrote that the rest of the city council was not willing to sign on, which was condemning the violence by the Israeli state in Gaza last year. I mean, that was a very serious issue. And the reason we did that was not only because it was morally compelling, but because there is a whole big movement in Seattle and in Washington state, which is extremely angry at what's happening in the Middle East. And so, you know, responding to those concerns and taking a stand when it's not popular. And I'll tell you how unpopular
it
was.
You can overdo it, and the council does overdo
it. Okay. Registered. I want to talk about, you bring up when the elite should decide, and when should it just go to the voters? Pure democracy, because that's going to come up when we talk about what I have a feeling might be your next project, Socialist Alternative Party. City Council Member Shama Sawant, Luke Burbank, Joni Balter.
I can't believe I've been calling them manhole covers all these years.
You didn't know that?
No, they're maintenance covers.
Jeez,
no.
Louise.
Stay tuned.
Come back, and we're going to report on Expedia traveling. See, it's ironic that Expedia would move from one place to another.
Yeah.
That and more on the Week in Review. From the Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail, you don't have to cover your mouth, Joni. You're jawing with Socialist City Council Member Shama Sawant, and that's a good thing. Luke Burbank, Livewire, TBTL.
Yeah. Those are all shows I work on.
Yes. That's the connection. That's the segue I'm making between Luke Burbank, Livewire, and TBTL.
Yeah.
You didn't think I'd be able to knit those together, but there
Fresh
is a through
of your
line.
Trip to Mexico, you're still sharp,
Thank
Bill.
You. This week, Expedia, speaking of Mexico, we booked it through Expedia, said that it's going to move its corporate headquarters from Bellevue to the old Amgen campus by Merle Edwards Park. The CEO of Expedia said the average commute time for his workers will only increase by 5 to 6 minutes. Wait a minute.
That seems strange.
It seems strange, right? Okay.
He gets to work by drone, as you know.
Yes.
Maybe they all work at home, because 3/4 of Expedia workers live on the east side, and some of them will move to Seattle, but a lot of them can't or won't. So the traffic technology company INRIX ran the numbers and said that Expedia workers living in Redmond and Sammamish will spend the equivalent of 3 weeks vacation time just commuting in the morning
every
year.
By the way, that was a really genius way to describe that amount of time.
Yeah.
Like, you could just say how many hours it is, but
instead
you're saying the thing you live for all year, the only thing that gets you out of bed in the morning are those vacation hours you will get to take, and that's what
right.
you're going to be using up.
See, INRIX has its data staff, and then it has one guy who's in charge of making metaphors.
Give that guy a raise, because that was very smart.
I agree with Luke. And I think, you know, you're talking about a city, the metropolitan area, that has the fourth worst traffic in the country. So, you know, regardless of whether or not Expedia were moving, traffic is so bad. You know, all other political questions aside, I haven't met a single person who disagrees with me on this question.
Really?
Yes.
I'm calling you out, Shama Sawant.
It's an incredibly unifying question. The question of why Seattle does not have a world-class mass transit system is a unifying question. Let's work on that. But, you know, inevitably, if we start having a serious conversation on that, and I know we're not doing seriousness this morning, but
we're not?
I'm serious.
This is
okay. Okay, my bad, my bad.
Game. This is
but listen, if we are going to have a real mass transit system here, we have to talk about sources of revenue. And we cannot do that unless we talk about progressive sources of revenue. Because I can tell you as an economist, even if you didn't care about poor people, the reality is that as long as the tax system is regressive, we're not going to raise the kind of revenue we need to raise, because the people who are being taxed the most, which is the low-income people, the middle class, all the working families, there's not much there. Where is all the wealth? The wealth is at the top.
Joni, you got to defend Week in Review. We talk about that all the time on this program, progressive and regressive taxes.
I'm glad to hear that.
Now, we talk about passive aggressive tips.
I'd like to talk about that too.
But I would like to add also that, and I'm sure it's regressive or passive aggressive or something like that, but Mayor Ed Murray is on a transportation thing and proposed a number that was eye-popping. You're not allowed to say a billion because it was only $900 million for new transportation.
Can yes, I just Luke. Mention that you know, my wife and I moved out of Seattle about a year ago, and one of the reasons and one of the greatest things for me about living where I live now out on the Olympic Peninsula is not being in traffic. And I stayed in Seattle overnight. And this morning, the drive from Ballard, where I was staying, to this studio in the U District was the most furious I've been in 1 year, just trying to navigate 45th. And I used to live in New York City when there was a transit strike. And it was the most incredible thing because all of a sudden you realize this is, you know, 10 years ago, there are 7 million people who are moving about this city in the subway. And when they don't have the subway to take, they all are above ground walking across the Brooklyn Bridge and trying to get. You realize how non-functional that city was without its mass transit. I feel that Seattle has approached non-functioning status. But the problem is, even if we start a project now, it's going to be years off. But I honestly feel Seattle is to some degree unlivable because of the traffic.
I was at a dinner last night with some Amazon folks, and to a person, people were just full-throated about how much they hate the traffic that has come. So love the growth, I suppose. Some people do. It fills the city coffers. But on the other hand, Luke Burbank can't get from Ballard to the station.
I mean, what a loss for this city that I had to move. Just think about that.
That's a big loss.
And come to this.
Rama, you should use it as a talking point.
Luke Burbank had to move out of Seattle. And not only that, I'm going to steal your non-functioning status.
Okay.
I think that describes it accurately. Seattle has approached, not is approaching, has approached a non-functioning status. And, you know, this is a day-to-day issue for people. And as I said, if we want to do mass transit, we have to talk progressive taxation. And as far as how long it would take, I think, yes, rail and subway would take longer. But there is an open secret of transit, that's bus service. There is nothing like bus service to move people from point A to point B. It works everywhere. It worked in the city of Mumbai, where I grew up, and I never owned a car there. So I think that we could rapidly move to a decently functioning mass transit system if we had a real funding to Metro. And don't believe these myths about how it's overfunded and the union needs to take cuts, you know, the Metro union needs to take cuts because they're not efficient. Actually, in reality, they're completely underfunded. Metro service is underfunded, and that's the question we need to discuss.
I want to capture the hate and fury that we referred to a moment ago on our roads here. When I see Hate and Fury, I try to
By the way,
Hate hug
and Fury 7 comes out this weekend.
Is that right?
Vin Diesel and the ghost of Paul Walker.
So here we are trying to accommodate all these growing corporations, Amazon, relocating corporations. Hello, Weyerhaeuser and Expedia and the condo dwellers and the cyclists and everybody all at the same time, which leads to things like what happened on Dexter Avenue, where a bicyclist wearing a video camera stopped to tell a driver that she had parked in the new bicycle lane.
This is your car?
Yeah.
You know this is not the parking lane, right?
I literally just ran it. You can keep going.
You know that
I literally
it doesn't matter.
Don't give a f- about anything you say.
That's great.
My car.
Okay, you do this. Yeah, that's this lane.
Oh my God, kill me.
This is the through lane. You're blocking through traffic. You do this again, I call the cops. Get out of here.
You are so ridiculous.
Thank you.
You can keep going.
Don't block f-ing traffic.
At least he accepts the compliment of ridiculousness. But after these two have argued for a while, a passerby gets involved, too. Somebody on foot who says, leave the poor driver alone.
That's it. It's a mistake. Just leave it alone. Go around her like everybody else.
All right. Go ahead and leave, and I'll be quiet. Go ahead.
And I tell you this story because the altercation goes to a place that I'm guessing you have been in your mind at some point. They tell the cyclist that he's the problem.
You're the reason why car drivers do not like bicycles.
You are the sole
you
reason.
You are the reason.
The one reason.
You, sir, are the reason why car drivers don't like cyclists. Who are your sympathies with in these collisions? And they happen. There's one happening right now in Seattle, I guarantee you.
What I would say is it depends on which mode of transportation you're on. So when I'm on my bike, I don't really dig the car people. When I'm in my car, I'm a little leery of the bike people. But this woman who was...
So your opinion of who's in the right depends on what transportation you're taking at the time.
But that woman went to swear words pretty fast for a native Seattle person, so she must be from New York.
I was talking with a colleague who said, who's from New Jersey, and he said on the East Coast, people would handle this so differently. They would go to the swear words and the gestures or whatever else, but it would be fast and furious. And then they would walk away from it, because this is the kind of interaction that happens all the time. You get the feeling that these two people will be losing sleep about this. Maybe only the bicyclist will be losing sleep about this in fury for a while.
But I also feel that, to go back to the comparison to New York City, I think if this sort of thing happened in New York City, it wouldn't have even happened. And by that I mean Manhattan, people, you have to park these delivery trucks in the middle of a tiny street. So then what happens? The cab driver has to drive up on the sidewalk. So then the bicyclist has to drive up on the sidewalk even closer to the buildings, which means the pedestrian has to kind of dodge around the whole bit. But the understanding there is we're all in this struggle together.
Right.
And the problem in Seattle, in my opinion, is everybody is very, very intent on staking out their piece of pavement. So I don't think anybody in this situation acquitted themselves particularly well. I think the cyclist who has the GoPro camera, like, so he can record every offense to his cycling persona, is being a little legalistic about it. The woman who says, "I literally don't give a bleep about anything you say," that's also not opening a dialogue.
First, I love that her first sentence was, "I literally just ran in."
Yeah.
First of all, you didn't literally run.
Right.
And
oh, so now this is a grammar debate.
Well, no, because when your mind goes to the justification that right. I was doing such a quick trip that you are in the wrong for even giving me the information that I'm parked illegally in front of where your bike can go.
You should respect my needs to run in there, even though
What I'm trying to say, though, is that this guy, I think, could have approached this. He could have ridden his bike around this car just fine. What he should have said, in my opinion, was, "Hey, I don't know if you know this, but that's where the bikes go now." It is, by the way, a little confusing, because for my whole life, it was you parked the car by the curb. Now you don't. Okay, fine. He could have just mentioned it to her. She would have known. He could have moved on. Maybe next time she acts differently. But instead, in this very Seattle, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours and don't come on my pavement, it blew up in a way it didn't need to.
Well, the fact that he could maneuver a GoPro camera and not get around her car, it just, like, I'm just trying to imagine this whole thing. It's like,
this morning we're comparing Seattle traffic altercations to those in New York City and perhaps Mumbai. City Council Member Sean Masawa, what's your perspective?
Well, I think as far as the nature of the altercation goes, I think Mumbaiites probably fall more in the New York City category, you know, being sort of direct, but also being used to the fact that you have to share it, as you know, Luke's example of delivery trucks and all, that's very relevant to a city like Mumbai as well. But I think, again, you know, the bottom line here is that because we don't have a functioning transit system, you have people who are on bikes angry at people who are in cars, and people who are in cars angry at people in bikes. And I think Joni's point was very honest and insightful, and I think this is true for a lot of people. If you're on your bike, at that moment, your sympathies lie with bikers. If you're in your car, you feel differently. And of course, you know, that's notwithstanding the plain scientific fact that if pedestrians and bikers are more at risk in terms of traffic accidents and all of that. But ultimately, the question is, why are there so many cars on the road? I mean, in America, most of the people who drive because they need to, not because it's a status symbol and because you're rich. In fact, most working people I've talked to say, "I hate driving my car. I would much rather be in a bus or a train where I can catch up on my sleep or talk to my child's nanny or something like that, something that, you know, makes my life go a little differently than..."
Not as much the child's nanny when we're talking about poor people.
No, not so much when we're talking about poor people. And in fact, the absence of a fully functioning transit system affects poor people the most, because maintaining a car, you know, if you add up all the expenses when you're living on $20,000 a year or something like that, I don't think anybody in their honest mind can claim that that's enough income to survive in a city like Seattle. And it's the responsibility of the politicians to make sure that they do something about this. That's what we need to do here.
Seattle City Council Member Sean Masawat started us this hour on the Weekend Review saying that we needed far more than $15. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. Producer Jason, are we taking a little break on Weekend Review? Okay, back in just a moment. TBTL and LiveWire's Luke Burbank is talking to Seattle City Council Member Sean Masawat, is talking with Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail, and I'm Bill Radke, and we're rounding up the week gone by for you. And this week, Seattle's minimum wage, as we've been saying this hour, began to rise toward an eventual $15 an hour. And I want to play a bit of KUOW reporter Deborah Wong's story on how Seattle got to 15. And then we'll talk.
As the committee worked, newly elected city council member Shama Sawant kept up the pressure both inside and outside City Hall.
We are not interested in a measure that is 15 in name only and has more holes than Swiss cheese.
Sawant led a small army of red-shirted activists called 15 Now, and they held the ultimate trump card. If they didn't get what they wanted from elected officials, they threatened to go straight to the ballot, just like in SeaTac, and get voters to agree on a much more aggressive minimum wage package. The SEIU's David Rolfe says the threat of a ballot fight initiated by either side motivated the committee.
Although it was sometimes unpleasant to be working under threat, the fact that we had both a deadline and consequences for missing the deadline was helpful to getting the parties to reach agreement.
The committee did come up with a compromise, a complex formula that phased in $15 over a series of years. It made big businesses raise the wage faster, over 2 to 3 years, and it gave small businesses both more time and more exceptions. In early June of 2014, the agreement went to the city council for a vote.
Good afternoon. Welcome back.
The chambers were filled with cheering, chanting activists.
It's 2:01 in the afternoon. I'm Tim Burgess, the president of the council. Will the clerk please call the roll?
During the final deliberations, Shama Sawant tried to make big businesses pay $15 right away, and she badgered her colleagues for not supporting her.
It's clear why I'm fighting to end the big business phase-in, but why is it that the council is not fighting for workers like Hannah? Why is it that the council is representing the CEOs of the businesses that exploit workers like Hannah?
To which her colleague, City Councilmember Bruce Harrell, shot back.
No one's on the side of big business. We're sellouts to big business. That's crap. That is absolutely crap.
But in the end, and after much speech-making, the bill passed, unanimously, in fact.
President Burgess.
Aye.
9 in favor, none opposed.
In signing the law the next day, Mayor Murray said he wanted Seattle's process to be a model for the nation. But not everyone was happy. Throughout the process, small businesses, and restaurants in particular, argued that the 60% wage hike could bankrupt their businesses. David Meinert is a nightclub and restaurant owner who was on the mayor's minimum wage committee. He says many of the city's businesses felt bullied by the process, but were forced to support the agreement because of what he calls political blackmail.
But I'm disappointed the way the process worked, and I'm disappointed in the other side personally attacking people. I felt like there's a lot of people on the left that should have been working together, and instead it got super negative.
Okay, that was KUOW's Deborah Wong on how Seattle got here to this week, the climb toward $15. And we have, besides Luke Burbank and Joni Balter, we have Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant sitting here listening to all of that. Council member, did you, in order to get to 15 eventually, did you have to accomplish that through, as we just heard, bullying that that has torn apart the left, whether it was worth it or not? Did that happen?
Can you imagine if her answer would be yes? That would be big news.
Well, maybe you had to break
a few eggs.
Let her answer.
Well, first of all, I have to say I hate listening to my voice, so I can't believe you made me go through that.
I'm sorry. You have a lovely voice.
I don't, and I have to torture myself by listening, and I hate seeing myself on camera, too, so that's one thing you have in your favor. It's a radio show. Mm. But as far as what happened goes, you know, I think we have to look at the broader context first and then, you know, talk about what exactly happened. And my interpretation of what happened is, you know, somewhat different than, say, Dave Meinert's or the CEOs who were involved. Firstly, as far as bullying is concerned, let's look at the facts. You know, if you see all across America, and Seattle is no exception, look at the statistics. I mean, these are real people that we're talking about. For the average worker, their salary has been, and if you compare that to the average CEO salary, the average CEO salary is 350 times the salary of a working person.
I really don't want to interrupt you. It is a live show. I just want to know whether you feel like the you had to crack a few heads. You're making the case for what you want, for a higher minimum wage.
I'll come to what you're saying. And my point is that let's not accept the narrative in the way that it's handed down to us. Who's bullying whom is the question. And as far as, you know, as you say, cracking eggs is concerned, this is also a little bit of a pretense on part of who's the people who are putting this narrative forward, in the sense that these are two sides, you know, CEOs, you know, profit-making entities and working people, their interests are in conflict. And the people who have lost the most in the last several decades are working people. So this idea that everybody can come together and live as a happy family is a myth.
Okay.
And let's not accept that. And yes, indeed, the charter amendment that 15 now put forward was the reason businesses gave in. And in fact, the Seattle Times reported on this. You have it straight from the horse's mouth. Don't accept it from a socialist. Go to the CEOs. They said... Accept it from a horse. They said that if it wasn't for the charter amendment, we wouldn't have given in. This is the reality. To get anything for social justice for workers, we have to fight. And ultimately, what we get is the outcome of a balance of forces. And that balance of forces is informed by the tactics and strategies you use. And the charter amendment tactic, or the ballot initiative tactic, was a critical component of the success in Seattle.
Nick Hanauer, one of the people who backed, with a lot of money, the $15 movement, Seattle businessman, wealthy guy, is saying that if the state of Washington doesn't raise its minimum wage, then he will use his money to get on the ballot $16. And some people are saying, you know, yes, people will vote for more stuff, but at some point it's irresponsible to put that to a vote without
it would be voters funny don't if have all the Tim Iman haters got behind a $16 an hour
that's
ballot.
The question the same people are saying, you know, Tim Iman will say you don't have to pay taxes, and people say fantastic. Whether they are budget experts or not, is it irresponsible to send this to the voters?
What I think is actually going on here is something that happened in 2012, if you think about it. I don't doubt the sincerity of Nick Hanauer and the eagerness to do this, especially now the Mike Baumgartner section of the show where he sort of killed the $12 possible statewide minimum wage.
This is the Eastern Washington Republican.
Right.
Yes.
But there is this sort of setting the table for elections that occurs, and it's not subtle. So in 2012, I remember I was in Olympia the day that the gay marriage legislation was signed by the governor, Governor Greg Warr. And I was talking to one of the Republican senators who said, "We're not worried about this. We'll just referendum it." And I said, "I thought you wanted to have your Republican candidate for governor, Rob McKenna, have a chance." Couldn't make the connection. Really? You can't? That and pot is on the ballot? You don't get what sort of setting the table for a ballot is? Some part of me thinks that that's what Hanauer is doing.
I will tell you this, and I believe I mentioned this on the show some months ago. I was traveling around the state doing some different things, and I do a lot of my research in dive bars. And I would listen to people outside of King County and people in Eastern Washington and other places talk about whatever they're talking about. And I was really struck by how often the $15 minimum wage came up as something that was really a burr under the saddle of people that live in the rest of this state. It fits into this narrative about Seattle and King County being some kind of crazy liberal bastion, all due respect to the councilwoman. I don't know why somebody in a different county in the state would be angry that there's a $15 minimum wage, but I'm telling you, it is a hot button issue out there, just perceptually.
You mean they want it, or they want it for themselves, or they?
Well, they probably secretly want it for themselves, but they find they resent the notion that it's happening because it fits into this idea of crazy liberal
elitist.
Yes, and I think Luke has, is onto something here, in the sense that a lot of working people in Eastern Washington need a wage increase themselves, but a lot of what they're thinking is clouded by what the right wing is saying in terms of, you know, what's bad for you, this is bad for you, that is bad for you. And it's really they're accepting that. But in reality, they need it probably more than middle class people in Seattle. And ultimately, I think, you know, the message for Republicans is, look, the writing is on the wall. A majority of Americans, a majority of Washingtonians agree $15 an hour is a good thing. And the state bill was for $12 an hour. If you don't accept that, then, of course, the ballot initiative move is a logical move. But really, the question is also for the Democrats. What is stopping the Democrats, where they have the majority, from doing minimum wage ordinances, in King County? King County Democrats could do that. Why don't you do it in the city of Bellingham? Point the way forward.
Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant is exhausted from her victory on $15, and I think she's done. I think she's spent and has no more fire in the belly.
That is not
is that fair?
Away from this, Bill. You have not been listening.
That's Shama Sawant and Luke Burbank and Joni Balter from the Seattle City Council and Live Wire and Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. We podcast this show, Shama. Are you going to listen back, or you hate your voice too much? Because it'll be on again.
I do listen because, I want to also, make sure that I'm making the most important points. And so it is my homework, but I do it with a lot of resentment.
Thank you for coming. Thank you, producer Jason Pagano. With resentment, I'm Bill Radke.